Alrighty. Welcome back, everybody, to the big question. Tonight, we are dealing with the question of free will. The sources were emailed out ahead of time, and if you did not get them, I can put them in the chat, as usual. Or if you have, but if you did not get them, let me know. Did everyone get them?
We got them.
Okay, fine. So not, I don't.
Yes.
But so I won't put them in the chat. Okay. So tonight's question is free will. I'm going to mute everyone so I don't hear the background feedback, or you can mute yourselves, whatever's easier. Mute all. There you go. Perfect. Okay. Tonight's question is free will. This is a big question, and we've touched upon it many, many times. What does that mean? What is free will? Do we have the freedom to choose what we do, or is everything we do divinely chosen ahead of time? Who makes our choices? This is a question that touches upon many, many of the issues that we've done so far. It touches upon tzadik v'ra lo, theodicy, the idea that why do bad things happen to good people? Does man have the free will? Can he freely choose to inflict pain and harm on someone else or not? It touches upon that. It touches upon bitachon. How much do we say everything's coming from God? Do we trust in God? How much of it is our own initiative? That's the question. Now, the question, there are many, many questions and sub-questions that can emerge from there. And this is what I hope to do. I want to just provide a little scaffolding for what it's going to look like. Today, I want to discuss what is free will in the simplest sense. I want to discuss why is free will important, some of the challenges to free will, and end off with why perhaps God has granted us free will. Part two, we're going to then begin our journey of discussing answers to the problems that we raise about free will and the nature of free will. So that is what it's going to look like. Source number one is the Rambam, Maimonides. We are familiar with Maimonides. We quote him probably every single shiur. And he lays out probably the classic explanation to what is free will. Meaning, I am sitting there and there's a big chocolate babka sitting in front of me and I want to eat it. On the other hand, it's not the healthiest thing in the world. So in my mind, I say to myself, I have two choices now. Either I can eat it. Well, I have three choices. But I have two primary choices. I can eat it or I can abstain from eating it. And then I make a choice. And depending on what I do, so either I live with the consequences of eating something unhealthy or I'm proud of myself that I abstain from eating it. So that's generally how when we think of free will. You think of a fork in the road and you can choose A, you can choose B, and what do you choose? As the Rambam says in source number one, Rishus kol adam nasnu. God has given Rishus, he's given everyone the ability to make a choice. Imrots lahatas atzmo derech tova liosadik arishus biyado. And this is obviously much more broadly and much more important than simply choosing to eat chocolate cake. Your life is a series of choices in front of you. You can choose to be a tzaddik, a righteous person, or imrots lahatos atzmo derech ra. God has given it within your control to choose to be a good person, to make good choices, to make healthy choices, to make choices that are positive or the negative, and to make negative choices, to make yourself not so righteous, evil, however you want to take that road. And obviously things aren't as binary as that in the sense of tzaddik versus rasha, righteous versus evil. But in general, the point that the Rambam is saying is there's nothing limiting our free will. We have the ability to choose or not to choose. We have the ability to go down route A, down route B. Two roads diverge in a narrow yellow woods, and you can choose which way you wish to go. That is the simplest explanation to free will. It's probably the intuitive explanation to free will. Now, we're going to skip to source number seven. I realize it probably makes more sense to say that first. Why would you think we don't have free will? What's the idea not to have free will? And I think it's a simple reason, and that is it's a simple philosophical issue. And this issue is raised by many, many people. Thomas Aquinas writes about it. Many of the medieval Rishonim, medieval philosophers in Judaism write about it. Everyone discusses it. And that is very simple. If we believe God is omniscient, God is all-knowing, God knows everything that's going to happen. God knows the future. Then how can it be that I can choose to do something other than what God intended. Meaning, if the day the world was created, let's go to that day, God knew every possible thing that was going to happen. God knew that on February 3rd, 2021, I'd be sitting here and giving a lecture. So then I have no choice but to give this lecture because that God knew about it ahead of time. So either you're going to say, God does not know everything. God does not know the future. And therefore, I can freely choose. And once I freely choose, then perhaps God will know. Or you can say, God knows everything that's going to happen. God knows the future. And therefore, I can't choose. And this is like the classic. I feel this comes up sometimes in literature. There's one scene in Harry Potter where this actually really comes up. I know I called Harry Potter literature. Some of you might say that's true. And some of you will probably throw rocks at me later or now or hang up. What, there's a scene there where Harry has the ability to go back into the past. And that opens up this whole can of worms, because once you go back into the past, I guess they can also, you know, look at it. When you go back into the past and reorchestrate something to happen so that to, let's say, kill someone or change the way things would fall out. Well, once you do that, you no longer have the ability in the future to let that play out, right? Again, to give another analogy, just to bring it home, if God knew from the beginning of time that on February 3rd, let's say I would choose to ride a bike today, although I wouldn't do that with all the ice outside and the negative 11 degrees that's coming our way, but if God knew I was going to do that, so then I have no choice but to do it, otherwise God would not know it. Is that clear? Does that make sense?
No, I don't feel that that's a contradiction. Just because somebody knows what's going to happen just means he knows what choice I'm going to make. I don't think knowledge of it bothers me. What bothers me is the whole discussion we had many weeks ago about theodicy. You know, what?
Right.
Why would God allow for bad choices? You know, and I know the answers, you know, various answers.
Right. And I think you're making a good point, Vivian, which we may come back to next week when we discuss some of the answers to this. But what, again, I think we could say I have a choice from today to tomorrow. I can have all the choice in the world that I am going to eat this piece of babka. But if God knew yesterday I wasn't going to eat it, so then I don't really have a choice. I could think I'm having a choice, but could it have been any other way? Did I have any other, could it have been that I ate the babka? No, because God knew yesterday I wasn't going to eat it.
The fact that he knows in advance, it's almost like maybe recording a show. I mean.
Right. So you're already touching upon Thomas Aquinas gives that answer. Or Sadi Gong is going to give us, start talking about that answer, that the path they're going, and we'll flesh it out more next week and discuss it more next week. But certainly the way the Rambam is going to formulate it and the way we'll meet some other philosophers and thinkers who are going to formulate it, this idea that God knows everything that's going to happen seems to imply everything is predetermined. And I'll add one more angle and one more caveat or one more point to this, which will strengthen it. According to medieval philosophy, God is one. Echad. That's what we say. God is singular. He's unified. If that is true, God cannot expand. God cannot grow. God cannot change. He's unchanging. To not know something, lack of knowledge, and then to learn it implies you are deficient. You are not that singular aspect. You had a lack. If I don't know, let's say I've never read, God forbid, I never read Great Expectations. Of course, everyone's read Great Expectations. No, I don't know if everyone has, but I had an English teacher who made me read it, and it was an experience. But if I, let's say I did not know that, so I am lacking in knowledge about whatever happens to Pip in Great Expectations. Now that I learn it, I have grown. I have become different. Something has changed about me. I was deficient, and now I'm more whole, if you want to put it that way. Can we say that about God? If God lacks certain knowledge, that seems to imply there's a lack in God. God is not perfect. There's something lacking in God. So if you want to take that route, which some of the philosophers are going to go down, which is, it includes the understanding of what knowledge is, so to imply God lacks knowledge and only learns about it when we make certain decisions also implies a problem with God's perfection. God is not as perfect as we want him to be. So that kind of puts you in this place where God has to know the future. But if God knows the future, then he knows what we're going to do. But then we don't have free will. So that's kind of the conundrum we're dealing with. The free will conundrum. And something's going to have to go. And if you look, I have a book over here. It's called Four Views of Free Will. And it's four philosophers, John Martin Fisher, Robert Kane, Derek Perboom, and who's the last one? Manuel Vargas. They all, these are secular philosophers, although some of them are religious people. They're going to basically make the argument in various different ways that something's going to have to go. Either you're going to take the approach that God doesn't know the future, or you're going to take the approach God knows the future, and we have less free will than we might want to have. But something's going to have to go in order to allow us to either have free will or God to know everything. So that's the approach, at least what we're looking at. That's the big question. How can we have free will if God knows what's going to happen? So that is the first part of the question. So now we're going to put that on hold. Let's put that on hold for a little while, maybe a couple of days. And while we think about that, again, for some of you, it might bother you more than others. I want to ask a different question, and that is, why is free will so important? Why is it so integral? Why is it so essential that we have free will? Imagine a world, imagine if we didn't have free will. And it's not like we are slaves, that we feel like we're enslaved and we're stuck and we have to do whatever our master says. But we live the lives we're living. And just imagine there was someone above us who we will never know about who is pulling all the strings. I feel free. I'm doing everything I do. I'm doing because I think I want to do. But someone behind me is pulling those strings. Can you imagine a world like that? Where we're kind of forced to do whatever it is that's planned out, predestined. Imagine we're in a... Has anyone here read Sophie's World? It's a book where the conclusion of the book is the protagonist doesn't realize she's actually a literary character. She herself is following the script that when they take a step out, that's being written in a book. She's part of the book. So imagine we are part of a script. Everything we say is scripted. Everything, there's someone who wrote a script 6,000 years ago and that we're living within that script. We can't deviate. We have no options. What's wrong with that? Why is free will so important? Why is it so essential? We have the freedom to choose that we need to even answer this question. That's a second question I want to ask. The person who's going to begin to answer that question is Chasdai Kreskes. Who's Chasdai Kreskes? So Chasdai Kreskes, if you look at source number two, he lived in 1340. He died in 1410. He was in Barcelona, Catalonia, and died in Aragon. So that is in France. In the Middle Ages, that was Spain. Spain was divided. It wasn't the unified country we know of it now. Lower Spain was under Muslim rule, and it was basically there was a Muslim caliphate in North Africa, which spread into southern Spain. And at various times, that those borders moved as there were different conquests and pushbacks, etc. Northern Spain, the Iberian Peninsula, the northwestern area of Spain, that was the kingdom of Aragon, Catalonia. Those were Barcelona's. For those of you who have been there, that is where there were many, many fasting Jewish thinkers, including the Ramban, Nachmanides, as well as Kreskes, Chasdai Kreskes, and the Ran. So the Ran, if you recall, a couple of weeks ago, we quoted the Ran, the Rabbeinu Nissim. He wrote a series of drushes of lectures. His student was Chasdai Kreskes, who was also a very important thinker. He wrote a book called The War of God, Or Adonai, the Light of God. And he basically tries to give over a philosophical treatise of, here's what Judaism thinks about things. It's interesting. If anyone knows of this, I haven't been able to find it. And if any of you wants to sponsor myself to go on sabbatical, maybe I'll write my PhD in this. So you have the Ran, Rabbeinu Nissim, who wrote these drushos, which are very important philosophical works. We've quoted it in the past, especially when we discussed Elu v'Elu about multiplicity and truth. And he has a student who wrote these Or Adonai, the Light of the Lord. So I wonder if anyone's compared and contrasted and seen overlap and where they disagreed and agreed. I think that'd be an interesting work to see, again, a student and teacher and how they both present the same issues. So he says the following. Why is it important that we have free will? Imagine, again, everything is scripted. What is wrong with that? Source number two. Hamaymer Hasheni Hakol Hamishi. In the second Maimer, in the second chapter, essentially, in the third Klal, is so in there he writes Aleph Bechira, free choice, free will. L'fi shekvar kodem lanu shemi yisodos adas hu habechira. The foundation of knowledge is to know we all have free choice. V'shaisa rishus kol adam. and this is, again, parallel language of the Rambam, and it's within everyone's ability. For us to choose to do good and do wrong, essentially. He said, from the perspective of God, it is only right and just that if someone commands us to do things, that we have the freedom to follow it. It wouldn't make sense, he says. It wouldn't be morally right for you or for God to command us to do things, but for us to lack the ability to make free choices. It's immoral. It's wrong. If you tell someone to do something and they don't have the ability to do it, you command them to do something when they totally lack the ability to do it, that's wrong. No one would tell someone in a wheelchair to run a marathon. It's cruel. It's immoral. It's not appropriate. So says Chasdei Kreskes, if God is giving us a Torah, and he's telling us, you have the ability to follow this. You have the ability to be moral. You have to be moral. You have to follow this. You have to do these mitzvahs. You have to be a good person. It would be immoral and wrong for God then to not give us the ability to follow through with that and to choose to make those decisions. And rather, each one of us is subject to whatever the script tells us, and some of us will do good, some will do bad, and it's out of our control. Again, it's immoral. It's wrong to command something to someone if you cannot control, ultimately, and make those decisions. So that's from the perspective of religion, if you want to put it that way. The second reason why free will is important, and this is when it really comes up in secular philosophy, in law, and I think this is really something that's important and pertinent to the world we live in now, and something people are struggling with today. So I got this from this is just a summary. If anyone's interested in philosophical topics, the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy is online. You can see the webpage there is plato.stanford.edu. And it's a wonderful resource. It's basically a more sophisticated Wikipedia for philosophy. So they choose who's going to write each entry. They'll choose the expert in that field, and they will write it and try to give you a summary of everything. And they say the following, source number 3. Why is free will so important? Why is it so integral for society to believe in free will? When an agent is morally responsible for doing something wrong, he is blameworthy. He deserves hard treatment marked by resentment and indignation and the action these emotions dispose us towards, such as censure, rebuke, and ostracism. However, it would seem unfair to treat agents in this way unless their actions were up to them. Thus, we arrive at the core connection between free will and moral responsibility. Agents deserve praise or blame only if their actions are up to them, only if they have free will. Consequently, we can assess analysis of free will by their implications for judgments of moral responsibility. Free will is so important because free will equals moral responsibility. If I can be morally held responsible for my actions, that can only happen if I freely chose to do them, which we know that's our legal system works that way. If someone is insane, if someone pleads insanity because they really have, they're not with it, and they do some sort of crime, it could be a heinous crime, we may lock them up in a facility, but only to protect themselves and the people around them, but not as a punishment. It's not punitive. Free will equals moral responsibility. When you choose to do something, so whether it's for good and we praise you, or it's bad and we punish you, or we look at you with indignation, how could you do such a thing? That only makes sense if there's more responsibility. In summary, what I'm trying to say is our society functions because we believe everyone makes choices. And based whether it's the right choice and we praise them for it, or the wrong choice and we yell at them for it or punish them for it, that's how we function. And if if we didn't have that free will, you couldn't hold someone to be morally responsible for things. If the judge got up there in court and said, How can you murder that person? The person said, I had no choice. Someone else held a gun to whatever it makes. Someone pushed me into it. Someone forced me to do it. Someone pulled the strings. So we're not going to tell the guy, oh, you're a horrible person. If you had no choice, if you were forced to do something, if you're not morally responsible, so it doesn't reflect on who you are as a person, we're not going to punish you. Free will is essential and integral for moral responsibility, which also means, just to plant some seeds for next week, if we can conceive of a way where someone is still morally responsible, even if they don't have freedom to choose. So maybe we can begin down an answer to some of our questions. But what I want to get out of this entry from the Stanford Encyclopedia is, again, free will is so essential, A, because if we live a life of command, if we live a life where God tells us to do things, so we surely have to choose, have the ability to choose to do the right thing or the wrong thing, but also because we can, if we have free will, only then can we introduce moral responsibility. Only then can we be responsible for things. Imagine someone got up there, we're going to get to this in a minute, and every time someone got to the court and said, well, I know I drove drunk, but like I wasn't free to choose. So you can't punish them for that. You can't punish someone if they did not make the choice themselves. The Rambam says this as well in source number 4. We don't have to read the whole thing inside, but in that, just a summary of that, the Rambam points out everyone can choose. You could be as great as Moshe Rabbeinu, Moses, the greatest prophet. You can be like him if you choose to live that life. Or you can be evil like Yerovam ben Nevat, who was a king in the time of Judea, a king in the Navi, who was an evil person. It's all freely chosen. No one's coercing you one way or the other. And he says, and then he then ends off, and that's where tshuva comes in, repentance. Repentance, again, tshuva only makes sense if we are morally responsible for what we did. If we have no free will, so it doesn't make sense then to turn to God and say, I'm sorry for doing what I did. You were coerced. You had no other option.
Can you define like how morality, the word morality, fits into this picture? Like, what is the framework for calling something moral?
So, again, I'm borrowing a term, and that we can go down a rabbit hole with that. But I think the best way to look at it is substitute moral with whatever. Framework which you want to see the world. So for a Jew, you can only be held responsible from on a level of yahadus and a level of religiously. It only makes sense for you to turn to God and say, I'm sorry, al chet, I'm going to do tshuva, I'm going to go through the Yom Kippur process if you are responsible for your actions. If you were coerced in something, so the halacha is, if you were coerced in something, you don't have to ask mechila, you don't have to do tshuva, you don't have to seek repentance for it, you had no free will. So whether, again, we want to talk in the religious Jewish vein through the lens of tshuva, when do you ask for repentance? Well, it only makes sense to ask for repentance if you freely chose to do the wrong thing, or to use moral or ethics in the secular sense. And you go to court and you say to a judge, you can't hold me morally responsible, you can't hold me responsible from a legal perspective because I had no free will, because, again, I may have been speeding, but I couldn't... The car was pre-programmed. For some reason, there was a glitch in the system. I'm driving my General Motors car, and it was pre-programmed that it accelerates and goes 150 miles an hour down a residential street. And let's say that's really true. The judge is not going to hold you responsible for that. You had no free choice. The car suddenly accelerates. You're sitting in the driver's seat, but you can't stop it. So that's what I mean by moral responsibility or religious responsibility. It makes no sense to punish this person. You tell him, get a new car. But he can't choose otherwise to have not accelerated. That answer your question?
Just thinking about it.
Okay, we can discuss more. We can discuss more in terms of also what morals are in general. There's a lot there. But that, again, I think that's a very good analogy. If you're in a car and the car accelerates and you don't have the ability to stop it, so that it's not your fault. It's not your fault, and you can't hold you more responsible. Rav Sadia Gaon lived in 1882, 1892. He was born around then, and he died in 882. So going over 1,000 years ago, and he died in 942. He was born in Egypt. He migrated when he was about 23 to Israel. So Egypt's down here, Israel's over here, and then he went all the way up to Babylonia. So think modern day Iraq, Iran, that area. So again, Egypt through Israel to Babylonia, where he lived out the rest of his life. A great scholar, a great polemicist, who spent a lot of time polemicizing against the Karaite sect, which was a deviant sect in Judaism. They did not believe rabbinic authority. They did not believe in the authority of the Talmud. Again, Babylonian Talmud. So the Talmud was written in Babel, in Iran, modern day Iran, Iraq, that area. And he spent a lot of time trying to separate the two communities to say, this is what authentic, traditional rabbinic Judaism is, and this is the Karaite Judaism, trying to help split and the community and create clear guidelines. So he writes a work called Emunos Videos. Do I have it here? I thought I had it here. I didn't have it. I've read it somewhere. Emunos Videos, which is a book of doctrines of beliefs and knowledge, where he spells out many of what is rabbinic Judaism, that's the best way to put it, their beliefs and knowledge. And when he gets to free will, he says, I am going to bring you four proofs that man has free will. Four proofs. And again, you could take it or leave it, but this is what he says. Number one, how do I know we have free will? He says, experience. Very simply, we feel it intuitively. We feel we're free. Intuitively, no one feels it, that we're being forced one way or the other. Maybe the cake looks really delicious, but at the end of the day, we know we're making a choice for the most part. Obviously, even halacha recognizes there's the category of a shota, someone who is coerced, someone who has something in their, an addiction, whatever it may be. But for the average person, on our decisions we make, we know we feel free. So just experience alone is one of the proofs that Rav Saadia Gaon brings. He then says, very similar to the Rav Chasda Kreskes, from a perspective of logic, it would make no sense that God would give us a Torah and then not give us the ability to choose to follow it. Meaning, however, we were predestined to go. So if I was predestined to keep Shabbos or break Shabbos, I have no choice in the matter. That doesn't make sense. If God's commanding us, logic dictates he gave us the ability to make a choice. Number three is, he quotes a pasuk, a verse. The pasuk tells us, God says to us in Devarim, "Ubecharta b'chayim, choose life." What does it mean to choose life? That can mean you're sitting there and choose the appropriate path in life. Choose the right way in life. So that's a verse. And lastly, he quotes a Gemara. The Gemara says, "Akol bidei shemayim, chutz meyiras shemayim." Everything is in the hands of heaven except fear of heaven. Everything is in the hands of heaven except fear of heaven. What does that mean? So there's going to be much debate, which we're going to return to next week on this. But Rashi, I think, takes one of the more minimalistic approaches to free will and says, what does it mean everything's in the fear of heaven? Look at source number 6. Everything about a person is in the hands of God. For example, whether he's tall or short, poor or rich, wise or foolish, light-skinned or dark-skinned, all this is in God's hands. Again, he's taking one approach. The Rambam may disagree. But for now, at least he's saying many things, whether I'm tall or short, what I look like, what my skin tone is, that's all in God's hands. I didn't have a choice in that. I can't choose whether I want to have brown hair or red hair. It's not naturally. It's not my choice. However, whether a person is righteous or a person is wicked, that's not determined by God. God granted man, he placed before him two paths, and man should choose fear of heaven. Meaning, I can't choose certain things. Certain things are natural to me. Certain things I'm always going to be, me, 6'10", I couldn't choose otherwise, and I'm always going to have brown hair. Well, at least until it turns white, or I lose it. But certain things are natural. What's not in my control? What I'm going to look like. For Rashi, whether I'm rich or poor. For Rashi, whether I'm going to be tall or short, wise or foolish. What is Yiras Shamayim? What is in my control? How I choose to live my life. Whether I choose to be good or bad. The choices I make in my life, that is within my control. That's what the Gemara says. And again, we're going to return to this next week. And we're going to see how there's an expanded definition of that. The Rambam's going to say the entire range of human activities is within Yiras Shamayim, within our choice. But again, Rav Saadia Gaon says, we have four proofs for free will. Intuitively, I feel it. It would make no sense for God to command if we couldn't follow. There's a verse that says, choose life. And this fourth one, the Gemara says, we have a tradition, the Masorah, Hakol bidei shemayim, everything is in God's hands. Chutz meyir shemayim, except for fear of heaven, which Rashi says means, whether the choices I make to be good or to be evil, those choices I make in life to do the right thing or the wrong thing, or more maximally, the way the Rambam puts it, the range of human activities. Now, so that's the first two. We looked at we opened up with what is free will. The challenge to free will from the perspective of how can God know if things are seemingly that would make things predestined. We then talked about why free will is important, A, because it wouldn't make sense for God to command things unless we can choose. We spoke about moral responsibility, how we can only be held responsible for something if I can freely choose. And that brings us to challenges to free will. So one, it's interesting to note, there's a midrash, the Midrash Tanchuma, which points out that the challenge to free will, people have been challenging free will from time immemorial, from the beginning of time, from the onset of creation. What happens? Oh, we open up the Torah, Parshas Bereishis, the very first parsha, and we encounter the story of Cain and Hevel. Cain and Abel. Cain kills Hevel, and Hevel is dead. He's laying there. His blood is literally laying there, and God comes to Cain and says, what did you do? You killed your brother. How can you do such a thing? And what does Cain say? He says, don't blame me. Who gave me the evil inclination? Who gave me the ability to sin? It was you, God. I didn't have the free will. I didn't have free choice. I'm exculpable here. I had no, you implanted within me the evil inclination, the desire to do wrong. So it's your fault, God. It's your fault. Since the beginning of time, people have been challenging free will because in a way, living without free will makes things a little easier, especially when we mess up. To go to the judge and say, and plead insanity, it makes things a little easier. You get off a little lighter, whether right or not. So that's one of the, again, the challenge of free will has always been there. Moreover, which we saw source number 9, which was Rav Ben Arsh, Rav Asaf Ben Arsh, puts really nicely the idea of God's omniscience, of God knowing everything versus us being able to choose. And then there's a rather new argument, and this is a very strong argument, and I think it's very relevant, and our judicial system is playing with it a little, and it's going to be very curious and interesting and slightly frightening how far it's going to take it. Dr. David Schatz wrote an article, Is Matter All That Matters? Judaism, Free Will, and Genetic Neuroscientific Revolutions. A mouthful right there. And basically he says, as we advance in mapping the brain, and we see how advanced our brains are, that we can even map thoughts to some extent. It seems that, and science is going this way, that so much of what we think is our consciousness, in a way, and the choices we make are really because of our physiology, the way our brains make up. There is a book called Incognito by David Engelman, and he basically says that if this is true, you may look at someone who is committing a crime and say, oh, how can you do that? But perhaps they're just wired differently. Their brains think differently. They're more predisposed to stealing or acting in certain and horrible manners, which for you, it's like, how can you do that? But they're predisposed to that. They're just, that's the way they are. Think addiction. Addiction is an illness. Some people are predisposed to towards addiction, and to start judging them and say, how can you do that? How can you make that choice to keep on engaging in that negative and destructive behavior? For them, it's like, I'm not making this choice. Part of it is the way I'm genetically built. And this is a very strong argument. Clearly, our legal system has not embraced this fully, because the way Dr. Engelman in his book Incognito pushes, he thinks we should eliminate all sorts of punishment, maybe keep some sort of jail for people who really, to protect society. But he says everyone, the brain, it's all mapped out. Thoughts are mapped out. Eventually, science will get there and they'll discover every one of our thoughts is mapped out and no one has any free will. It's all genetics. It's all genetics, which is another very powerful argument towards free will, against free will. It's all genetics. We're all predisposed, even our thoughts. So again, science is not there yet. And I think there's a long way to go before we can really prove this. But Dr. Schatz is worried about this. He's worried about the implications of blaming everything on genetics, of getting rid of moral responsibility, of getting rid of, therefore, the free will. He writes in Source 10, the materialist revolution is profoundly altering how we conceive of mind and personality. Neuroscientists seem to be successfully mapping a gamut of mental phenomena onto states of the brain. This is, again, source number 10. From higher level cognitive functions to emotions and personality traits, to raw experiences of color, taste, and sound. Moral judgment, economic choices, religious experiences, and religious beliefs are linked to neural excitations. Simultaneously, geneticists I've explained how neural pathways are set and identify genetic causes of character traits, personality disorders, and the like. You think of the horrible practice before people knew better of basically getting rid of someone's frontal lobe in their brain. And if you're familiar with this was done till, unfortunately, much more recently than we want to admit, where they would essentially remove people who were having seizures and other disorders, remove the frontal lobe of the brain, and it would profoundly alter people's personalities. People who have traumatic brain injury, profoundly, you'll have a nice, quiet person, a traumatic injury, profoundly alter their personality and they become cranky people, they become people who are irritable or whatever it may be. So then the argument here is, how much can we blame a person if it's all in the brain? So we're going to have to address this too. And I don't know how well we can address it because it's a very new territory, but this too is a real challenge to free will, to moral responsibility. So that is the challenges. And I want to wrap up with two ideas. A few weeks ago, we read a piece, a famous midrash, which we're going to read again and have a different take on. The Torah in Bereishis Aleph Chavav writes, "Vayomer Elokim," God says, "Na'aseh Adam," let us make man. Let us make man. So Rashi jumps up there and goes, who's God talking to? This is the sixth day of creation. There's no one there. So there's a midrash. And the midrash quotes, and again, you might sound familiar because we read it a few weeks ago. Rav Simon says, Rav Simon, Simon, Bishah Shibah HaKadosh Baruch Hu Livores Es Adam HaRishon. The moment that God wanted to create man, Nasu Machai Sharas Kitim Kitim. All the angels gathered around God. V'chaburus chaburus. They split up very quickly into different camps. And they began to argue, should God create man or should God not create man? Mehem Amru Al Yirbeth. Some said, God, don't create man. It's the wrong thing to do. Mehem Amram Yirbeth. Another said, no, create man. Chesed Omar, the group of angels that represented kindness, they said, Yivre, create man. Shu Gomil Chasad, the man is capable of such amazing things. Man is capable of such amazing acts of kindness. How can you not create a man and prevent these acts of kindness from taking place? The Emes Omar, but Emes, truth, jumps up and says, yes, man may be capable of kindness, but Shkul Sheker, man lies. Man is full of lies. We know this. Think, man lies. Tzedek Omer, righteousness gets up there. So it's chesed and says, Yivreshu Oset Tzedakos, man is very righteous. Not only does he do chesed, kindness, he's righteous. Shalom Omer, but peace gets up there and says, Al Yirbe, the Kula Katata. God, man is going to wage war. Man is going to fight. They're going to be acrimony. They're going to fight with each other. Don't create man. Why do you want to create a world that's going to be full of so much acrimony? Why do you want to be create a world that's full of so many lies? And what this midrash encapsulates is that from the beginning of the world, God knew when he created man, it wasn't going to be simple. He was going to create a man who had the ability to be at once full of chesed, full of kindness, but also full of sheker, full of lies. A man who had the ability to be tzedek, to be righteous, but also to fight and to be full of war. And that's part of what it means to be man. We were created this way. We were created in a way that we could make these choices. And that's just who we are as people. It was thought of before the world was created, and there were those who said do and those who said don't. That's one approach to this. I think there's a second approach, which is I found to be beautiful and really inspiring. Perhaps when God said, Nasa Adam, let us create man, who was God talking to? Not to the angels, but God was talking to man. God was saying to man, I am going to create you. And I'm going to create you with all your abilities, with all your titles, with all your inclinations, whether they're good or whether they're bad. And it's your job to Nasa Adam. I am going to create you, Nasa to create, but also Adam, you too have to create. You too have to build yourself. You too have to create yourself. Part of being human, if you want to be human, means you have to build yourself, means you have to live a life of choices. And sometimes they may be good, and some of those choices may be bad, but that's what it means to be an Adam. That's what it means to be Nasa Adam, to create man. God's creating us, and we are partnering with him to finish that creation. He's saying, let's do this together. And therefore, we have to have that ability to be a man, to be men. As mankind, we need that ability. And although sometimes it ends up in sheker, it ends up in lies, and sometimes it ends up in war, but that's the only way that we can also end up with righteousness and kindness. So thank you very, very much.
Thank you.